Strange, Punks and Drunks and Flicks and Kicks, written and read by Richard Strange. Episode 41. By the time we returned from Turkey, Duncan Ward was already into his new project, a film called Doorways to Dunbar. Once again, it was a piece in the absurdist style, and it was loosely a series of filmed encounters with a disparate group of individuals who all remembered the enigmatic disparu Rex Dunbar, the dead man in his earlier film Dead Men Don't Remember, in different ways. A private dick has been engaged by a wealthy dowager to try and hunt down Dunbar, and his investigations bring him into contact with a salty cross-section of London's demi-monde. Christopher Chaplin played the private eye, a splendid actor with the most extraordinary gene pool. His father was Charlie Chaplin, and his maternal grandfather was the Irish playwright Eugene O'Neill. He's blessed with one of the most photogenic faces I've ever seen, the sort of face that is always well lit, with all the dark-eyed, saturnine good looks that his father had as a young man. Once again, many of the actors of the company were co-opted to give their services for the scant reward of a running buffet and a lot of laughs. The quirky red-haired Rose Keegan, best known for her role in TV's Hearts and Bones, Rupert Maxwell, Katrina Boorman, Roddy Maud Roxby, Damien Berger and I, all chipped in with cameos, as did the Paris-based English actress Charlotte Rampling. In a ludicrous but hilarious scene, I played an acid-damaged porn photographer, surrounded in his studio by a dozen inflatable sex dolls and a single cowering naked model. Mid-interview, the photographer enlists the bewildered Chaplin to help him inflate the remaining dolls, which take on ghastly, spectral shapes as they're slowly filled with human breath. As so often happens with Duncan's work, both before and since Doorways to Dunbar, he undermines his many strengths by an inability or an unwillingness to collaborate in areas where he is weak. He has a good filmmaker's eye, good sense of design for lighting and for framing a shot, plus an easy facility with actors and an ability to raise money. He's an old-style chisel-featured roué whose high-maintenance running costs are paid by a combination of private income, hack work and infatuated wealthy spinsters. But what he's not especially good at, as I've noticed and discussed with him many times, is writing. This is a major problem and the reason why much of his work is hobbled. As they say on Broadway, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. He has too much pride or vanity to enlist the help of others in this crucial area, with predictable results. The film was finished, and then, in a sequence of events familiar to those who've worked with him on Dead Men Don't Remember, it was shelved, deconstructed, partly reshot, revoiced, fiddled with, edited till it lost all sense, and hasn't been seen since. The architect Mike Rundle has been involved in the design and building of Pharmacy, Damien Hirst restaurant venture on Notting Hill. Before it even opened, the restaurant was controversial, with local residents asking that it be renamed as it might confuse people who wanted to buy an aspirin. They merely rearranged the letters so that one night it was called Army Chap and the next Achy Rump, and so on, until the local council came down on the side of common sense and they just rearranged and renamed the restaurant Pharmacy. When the restaurant finally opened in spring 1998, there was, of course, a massive and totally chaotic party. It was chaotic because they had dramatically underestimated the number of guests who would actually turn up, and for some reason, the water supply ran out, and there was a fire in the kitchen. About 20 fire engines arrived and blocked the whole of Notting Hill Gate. It was sheer bedlam. We headed across the road and ate pizza at Pizza Express. When we eventually got into Pharmacy for dinner, about a week later, I went to chat with Maya, Damien's girlfriend, who was having dinner at another table with Mariella Frostrup. She was in great form and suggested that I go down to the farmhouse that she and Damien had bought in Devon for the weekend. She told me where the house was, and it was part of the Devon I remembered from childhood holidays. It was a favourite place of mine. We drove down and met Damien in the village pub, where he was already a great favourite with the locals, and was probably single-handedly keeping them in business outside the tourist season. We played a few games of pool and chatted with Damien and Pam Blundell, the fashion designer, who was also staying at the house. By the early evening, Danny Webb, my friend who'd played Hamlet, arrived with his wife Layla. Danny is a fanatical surfer, and he and Maya took advantage of some lively seas to indulge their sickness. Damien was a little like a child with a new toy, proudly showing us the library and the snooker room. And in the evening, Damien cooked a delicious dinner, and there was a great air of conviviality about the place. There had recently been a falling out between Damien and Marco Pierre White, the ill-tempered chef at Damien's first restaurant venture, Quo Vadis. The spat ended with Damien removing all his art from the restaurant and White replacing it with his own. Having seen White's artworks and tasted Damien's cooking, I think on balance that Damien is the more multi-talented. We spent the weekend in Devon walking, chatting, eating and drinking. It was great to spend some time with Danny again, and while we were at the house, we relaxed and listened to a lot of music. Damien had just got hold of the Beach Boys' Rarities and Outtakes of the Pet Sounds CD, and we played it over and over. I told him about Nick Kent's excellent book, The Dark Stuff, his collected interviews with the more eccentric rock stars, of which the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson is a contender for the greatest fruitcake of all. He had never heard of it, so on returning to London, I sent him a copy. Damien is a complex, erratic, infuriating character, sometimes seemingly hopelessly trapped in his bad boy of British art caricature, but possessing a rare and mercurial talent. He's responsible for some of the most memorable images of the last decade of the last millennium and will, without doubt, be one of the artists whose work endures long after the silliness and excessive Brit art are forgotten. Like many artists of his generation, his work veers between the sublime, the sheep, the shark, the horse's head, the medical cabinets, etc., and the silly, the spot paintings, painted by his chums for 10 quid an hour and selling in excess of 100,000 quid, the spin paintings and the restaurants. But when it works, it's impressive, monumental, emotionally and intellectually challenging art. Incidentally, and importantly, he also has the wordsmith's gift with his titling. I want to spend the rest of my life everywhere with everyone, one-to-one, always, forever, now. The ping-pong ball on the column of air. Or the physical impossibility of death in the mind of someone living, the shark. And some comfort gained from the acceptance of the inherent lies in everything, the sliced cows, being but three examples. He's not just a metaphysical taxidermist, but if he were only that, he would be unique, and that would be almost reason enough to cherish him. The self-obsessed art of the Brit pack, of Tracy Emin, of Webster and Noble, for example, the mythologizing of their little lives, will, I think, be seen as tiresome and irrelevant. I believe that Jake and Dinos Chapman are almost unique among their generation in bringing an intellectual rigour to their work, and the high concept work of Darren Armand, Richard Wilson, Connie Parker, Langlands and Bell, Rachel White-Reed, Mark Wallinger and Gavin Turk will always repay closer contemplation, but most of the others just bleat and whinge. You may disagree. For part of August, I was back in the West Country again, this time with the Occasionals, my old cricket team. It was always an enjoyable tour playing local teams in between sightseeing and ribbing each other about the previous day's lamentable performances. My tour was truncated by a call from Michelle telling me that I'd been offered a part in a big-budget US TV film of Alice in Wonderland. It was an offer of 3 weeks' work for good money, shooting at Shepperton Studios and starting immediately. I said goodbye to my willow-wielding colleagues and drove straight to Shepperton, where I met Joyce Galley, the first casting director I'd ever encountered 14 years earlier, when Karina Cooper invited me to Shepperton to meet Frank Rodham. Joyce, the woman effectively most influential in my becoming an actor, was a casting director in Alice in Wonderland and offered me the part of one of the playing cards. "It's not a huge part, darling," she said, "but it's a very nice part." She half apologised, as casting directors invariably do. She didn't need to. I knew that the production company Hallmark were involved in making high-quality, big-budget adaptations of classic English books, and they did them well. They'd made Gulliver's Travels with Ted Danson the year before, which was a superb piece of work of its type, and they were following a quite simple formula. They adapted a much-loved book, hired actors who were not quite at the top of the Hollywood tree, spent a lot of money on lavish costumes and design, and got a good director in to ensure the whole thing worked. Nick Willing directed Alice, and the cast included Miranda Richardson, Whoopi Goldberg, Simon Russell Beale, Jason Fleming, and Robbie Coltrane. The role of playing card was not, as you might imagine, an overtaxing one. Once the croquet game was finished and I was left with a lot of time on my hands in my dressing room, with the collaboration of a couple of the other cards, I started to think about how best to use my time at Shepperton, and hit on the idea of making a short video of our own. We decided to make a sort of Ed Wood-style low-budget sci-fi spoof, originally limiting ourselves to only filming in our dressing room to see how creative and inventive we could be. We called the project I, Morbius, and it seemed to have the appropriate 50s schlock ring to it. Our intention was to film on a home video camera a 5-minute piece of nonsense which we could show at the cast and crew party, the traditional get-together at the end of filming when the production company digs into what's left of the budget and hosts a party. Usually the stars have already left for another job, or they're heading to LA to berate their agents for not having another job lined up. But the supporting actors and the technical people will almost go anywhere for a free drink and a chicken drumstick. Somewhere along the line, however, I, Morbius became an altogether different proposition. It became the reason I went to work each day, far superseding Alice in Wonderland in importance in my mind. Indeed, whenever a second AD had the temerity to come to our dressing room to tell us we were required on set, it seemed like an unfortunate and unreasonable intrusion. Every night I wrote a script for the following day, and gradually the reputation of I, Morbius had spread across the entire cast and crew. To be offered a cameo part in it became something of a seal of approval. The story had been expanded from a sci-fi spoof to hard-boiled absurdist film noir, complete with spaceships, crazed intergalactic tyrants, a 50-foot woman, and the bloody body of a transvestite in the shower. I coaxed Miranda Richardson into playing the shaven-headed supreme leader of the world, wrote her a speech, and even directed the former Oscar nominee in her performance in her dressing room. She didn't need much direction, it must be said. She is a supremely talented and instinctive actress, probably the best of her generation. Not locked into any stylistic straitjacket, she can play glam or dowdy, comic or straight, and possesses an intensity rarely found in English actresses. Simon Russell Beale and the young American actress playing Alice, Tina Majorino, sat in a car park and quaked with fear as the 50-foot woman rampaged through the set. And Jason Fleming, hot from Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, played Jackie Hertz, a hard-nosed Pittsburgh cop. His performance was only slightly undermined by the fact that, since he was playing the Jack of Hearts in Alice, he was obliged to have his wig in curlers for most of his scene. As the project spiralled out of control, I started writing cameo parts for friends outside of Alice. Marie Helvin played an embittered drunk supermodel, fabulously. In October in New York, I filmed Tony Torn, the son of the American actor Rip Torn, and a very good actor in his own right, as a Tourette's syndrome-afflicted husband of the Supreme Leader. We shot his improvised scenes in a supermarket on 9th Avenue, and typically for New York, no one batted an eyelid as he ranted and raved and pushed his trolley down the aisles, dressed only in a dressing gown and sneakers. You will understand why the project collapsed under the sheer weight of its ambition and why there are now 9 hours of rushes sitting accusingly in a cupboard at my home awaiting editing. I also wanted Christina to play a bedridden, heavily bandaged cosmetic surgery patient, but typically she couldn't quite fit it in with her social calendar. It was especially galling as I'd already splashed out on the bandages at Duane Reade Drugstore on Broadway too. She did, however, tell me that Michael Zilker, her former husband and the man who signed me to Z Records, had recently sold his 12-year-old business, Zilker Energy, for $1 billion. The reason I was in New York for October was to attend the opening of an exhibition of mainly unseen paintings by Francis Bacon at Tony Shafraz's Soho Gallery on Worcester Street. Brian Clark, for reasons too complex to go into here, had become the executor of the Francis Bacon estate, and a lot of previously undiscovered work was unearthed after Bacon's death in Madrid in 1992. Appropriately enough, the private view for the show of these ghoulish slices of bacon was held on Halloween Eve, October the 31st. Now, the Americans celebrate Halloween in a way that leaves the Brits open-mouthed. They love to get into devil costumes, witch costumes, skeleton costumes, ghost costumes, with a fervour rarely seen outside of Mexico. When they're not in traditional costumes of the festival, they dress as rock stars, movie stars, or pieces of furniture. In London, no self-respecting trendy would go to a high-profile cultural event in costume for fear of not being recognised. In New York, they don't give a damn. In fact, they relish it. This made star-spotting at the private view a hazardous affair. Is that someone dressed as a dead Lou Reed over there? Or does Lou Reed really look like that? In a fabulous moment of absurdity, there was a call to the gallery from Leonardo DiCaprio's publicist saying, "Leo will be coming to the show with three friends. They will be dressed as the rock band Kiss. Make sure the photographers know that that's Leo, okay?" Tony's assistant took the call and duly alerted the paparazzi to the imminent arrival of the superstar. Sure enough, within 10 minutes, a sleek limousine purred up outside the gallery, and four young men dressed as the rock band Kiss ran into the gallery. Flashbulbs popped, the costumed and marked quartet posed for the cameras, drank a glass of champagne, and split. The photographers were delighted until, 5 minutes later, another limo drew up outside, and another, visibly different version of the rock band Kiss sprinted as best they could on 8-inch platforms, the 5 yards required to get them into the sanctuary of the gallery. Once again, flashbulbs popped, and the costumed and masked quartet posed for the cameras, drank a glass of champagne, and split. Of course, ultimately, it didn't matter which version of the band were plastered across the gossip columns of the next day's papers, as they were all masked anyway, so long as the name Leonardo DiCaprio appeared underneath the picture. But the nature of celebrity is such that, at that point in time, it was a matter of life and death. The fact of the matter was that Leo sort of owed Tony a favour, as Tony had been the first to introduce him to Robert De Niro and Johnny Depp, introductions which effectively turbocharged DiCaprio's career.